KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We love this place. We adore this place right here. And look at it right now. It looks like a ghost town. It looks like being realistic, people are just scared because of ICE.
In LA, ICE raids have some people afraid to gather in public.
And one historic Latino neighborhood is feeling the impact.
For Friday, June 20th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. European diplomats are working to revive nuclear negotiations with Iran in an effort to end violence in the region.
The expansion of this conflict could ignite a fire that no one can control. We must not let that happen.
Also, the story of a woman who, after a lifetime of working in medicine, decided it was time for a change.
Now she spends her time teaching people how to cook delicious food.
I took a tour of their pantry and I'm like, well, I see a big problem here. Like, you have nothing to flavor this stuff.
And what to look forward to in Game 7 of the NBA Finals.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump says it would be difficult to ask Israel to call off its airstrikes on Iran, but he says he might be okay with a ceasefire while negotiations take place. NPR's Deepa Shivaram has more.
Trump says he might support a ceasefire during talks to negotiate the conflict between Israel and Iran, which began 1 week ago when Israel attacked Iran with a wave of airstrikes. He said Israel is, quote, doing well in terms of war, and it's hard right now to make the request to Israel to stop their attacks. Trump said Thursday he would decide whether or not the U.S. would get involved in the conflict and directly strike Iran, quote, within 2 weeks. He says the two-week period is to, quote, see whether or not people come to their senses. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
A federal judge is holding off on any additional rulings on the National Guard in California for now, leaving it in Trump's control. This after an appeals court yesterday gave Trump a key procedural victory, saying he can keep control of the state's guard during California's court challenge. U.S. District Court Judge Charles Breyer asked lawyers, though, for both sides to file briefs on Monday. A federal appeals court says a Louisiana law requiring public colleges and schools to display the Ten Commandments violates the Constitution. Aubrey Juhas of member station WWNO has more.
A three-judge panel on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans ruled unanimously that the law is plainly unconstitutional. The decision upholds a lower court's ruling that blocked Louisiana from enforcing the law when it took effect in January. Louisiana's Attorney General Liz Merle argues that it only applies to schools in the five parishes named in the suit, and that the Ten Commandments should be displayed in all other classrooms. Merle says in a statement that she strongly disagrees with the Fifth Circuit's ruling and plans to appeal, if necessary, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Aubrey Juhas in New Orleans.
New research shows people treated for breast cancer are slightly less likely to develop Alzheimer's. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study in the journal JAMA Network Open.
Breast cancer treatments, including chemotherapy, hormone therapy, and radiation, can cause short-term problems with memory and thinking. But a study of more than 70,000 breast cancer survivors in Korea found the treatments did not increase a person's long-term risk for Alzheimer's. Patients followed for up to 9 years after surgery were about 8% less likely to be diagnosed with the disease than similar cancer-free individuals. Chemotherapy and hormone therapy were not associated with any change in risk, but radiation therapy appeared to decrease the chance of a diagnosis. The study's authors say that may be because radiation can improve cognitive function by protecting certain brain cells. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Wall Street ended the day in mixed territory. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Dozens of Kroger supermarkets across the U.S. are going out of business. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports the food grocery giant says it has to reorganize after its plans to acquire a major rival collapsed.
Kroger's mega merger with Albertsons fell apart in December, losing in court to the Biden administration. The deal was pending over 2 years, and in that time, Kroger says it did not close any of its underperforming stores like it normally would. So now comes a wave of those closures. 60 locations will close across the country, though no specific details yet. In its earnings report, Kroger also says sales, excluding fuel, grew 3.2% in the latest quarter as people are eating at home more often. And on tariffs, Kroger forecast a, quote, minimal impact, saying few of its items have been affected and it's pushing suppliers to eat new costs and discontinuing some items to avoid tariff hikes. Alina Seluch, NPR News.
In Hawaii, the Kilauea volcano is erupting again, sending lava fountains shooting 1,000 feet into the air as lava flows erupt. The USGS's Hawaiian Volcano Observatory says this episode was preceded by small, sporadic sputtering and lava overflows. Kilauea is one of the most active volcanoes in the world. It's located on the Big Island, and it's been very active in the past several months, erupting dozens of times just since December. Crude oil prices lower by the close, down about 0.2%, ending at $75 a barrel even. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles. Here on the east side of the city, in the majority Latino neighborhood of Boyle Heights, there's a traditional Mexican market full of colorful stalls that's been here for more than a half century. It's called El Mercadito.
We love this place. We adore this place right here. You know, you got the tostilocos with esquite. You got the ice cream, you got the raspados, you got the aguas frescas, you got the...
Jose Morales has been coming here since he was a kid. He's 31 now, and today he's stopping by to get a raspado, or shaved ice. He says with school out for the summer, kids would normally be right here buying their favorite snacks and trinkets, but today it looks so different.
It looks like a ghost town. It looks like being realistic, people are just scared because of ice.
ICE, as in Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The raids that have swept through Los Angeles in recent weeks have kept many people in Latino communities at home, out of fear that they'll become targets. When asked about the raids in Southern California this week, Todd Lyons, the acting director of ICE, told ABC News that, quote, "We no longer turn a blind eye to someone who is in this country illegally." But the fear of being targeted even extends to Latinos who are U.S. citizens, like Morales.
I came out to get my birth certificate, other errands that I had to do out here. And
wait, you came out here to get your birth certificate? Why do you need your birth certificate? Why do you need to get it right now?
With everything going on, it's just kind of like, you gotta be very careful nowadays because you have people getting stopped and, you know, certain officers that are ICE, you know, they're not even showing you a warrant or anything like that. They're just grabbing people, at least what I'm seeing on social media.
So you intend to be keeping your birth certificate on you at all times?
Yeah, I have to, you know. Because
this fear of the raids has decimated business at El Mercadito. We see hardly any customers now, as one of the building's managers, Marlene Rosado, walks us through the market.
Just walking down this aisle, you'll have barro, which is our pots and pans that are made out of clay, or talaveras, and you have jarras, where you would press your fresh aguas, leather goods, your belts.
The vendors mostly stand around idle. One shopkeeper tries to draw customers in with a serenade on a tiny accordion.
This is like a toy store.
Yes, this is a toy store. Ah. Exactly, our toy store.
Look at that little baby white guitar there.
Yes. Little mariachis in the making.
I love that.
There are more than 100 stalls here, but more than half of them are closed. Their goods are locked up behind gates or covered with tarps.
Our community is genuinely scared to leave their homes at moments. Mm-hmm. And many of the vendors here are also afraid to open shop.
So all these gray tarps that I see hanging over the fronts of stalls, this is more than usual. It's usually not covered up like this.
No, they all open about like 10 a.m. sharp.
How does it feel to see this place you're so used to seeing crowded and bustling look like this now?
Not gonna lie, I've cried walking like around just to like check on them, and this is their life. Like, it's really disheartening.
Rosado says many vendors just don't see the point in opening up because there are so few customers, or they're scared of being mistakenly detained by immigration agents. And some younger U.S.-born family members are showing up to help keep shop, like a young woman we met working in a stall that her family has run for decades.
So I've been basically like calling off of work to come help my grandma because unfortunately a lot of employees quit or they're just not coming because they're scared. Everyone's paranoid, so it's sad. And it's kind of like contagious energy, like I get paranoid, even if I'm okay, like a U.S. citizen.
She requested that we not use her name because her family's concerned they could be targeted by ICE. Her grandma has been on edge too, even though she says she is a lawful permanent resident.
She's also scared because she doesn't speak English.
Grandma?
Yeah, mm-hmm. If those people come and they try to like terrorize her with a bunch of questions, she's not gonna know like what to do, so I have to be here.
Why do you think she still wants to show up at work day after day even though she is nervous right now?
Because this is our source of income, and like we don't want to just give up and like let the fear control us in a way. But I told her we shouldn't open, to be honest. Like I told her, like, what are we doing? But she's like, well, you know, we need to get money, and like, so it's been kind of stressful.
Meanwhile, outside, among the food vendors, Julia Vasquez stands behind a long row of vibrant jugs of aguas frescas, still full of watermelon, cucumber, and passion fruit waters. In normal times, she says, these jugs would almost be empty now in the early afternoon. But now, business is so slow.
Muy bajo, los negocios han bajado.
Vasquez says business isn't even a quarter of what it normally is. She has to dump all these unsold aguas frescas at the end of the day. Vasquez has been running her shop for 42 years. She says she started off as a teenager, selling these waters from a cart. Then 20 years ago, she got her permanent residency. And today, she owns 3 stalls at El Mercadito.
How does it feel to come here, start your business at 16, make your own money, do everything the right way, and now decades later, this is happening to you?
Vasquez says she is worried about making rent for her business and for her home, but she has faith that God will look out for her. We asked Marlene Rosado if she shares the same optimism that things will turn around.
I am very hopeful because I have a lot of faith in our community and our strength as Hispanic, Latinos, Mexicans that are here in Los Angeles and all our immigrant community. I know that a lot of fear has been instilled, but don't let that be the underlying message. It has to be strength in numbers, strength as a community. Together, we are a force.
So, for now, even though the halls of El Mercadito look so empty, you can hear they're still alive. As the vendors find comfort in one another and wait out this uncertain time.
Diplomats are anxious to revive nuclear negotiations with Iran. President Trump says he will decide within 2 weeks whether to join Israel in bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. European diplomats say the only way to resolve international concerns about Iran's nuclear program is through a diplomatic deal. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more.
At the United Nations, the Security Council met for a second time in a week to discuss Israel's war with Iran. Secretary General Antonio Guterres called this a defining moment for the world.
The expansion of this conflict could ignite a fire that no one can control. We must not let that happen.
He urged Israelis and Iranians to give peace a chance, and that means getting Iran back to the negotiating table for a nuclear deal. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, says a deal is within reach.
Elements for an agreement have been discussed. The IAEA can guarantee through a watertight inspection system that nuclear weapons will not be developed in Iran.
But Israel's ambassador to the UN accuses Iran of having a secret nuclear weapons program that was not under the watch of the International Atomic Energy Agency. So Danny Danon says he's skeptical about the latest push for a diplomatic solution.
The Iranians are the masters of deceptions. They lied for so many years, so we cannot just play the game with them anymore.
As Iran and Israel continue to trade missile fire, the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and the UK sat down with Iran's foreign minister in Geneva, along with the European Union's top diplomat. They expressed their willingness to meet again, but Iran's Abbas Araghchi says his country won't negotiate while the Israeli strikes continue. At the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva earlier in the day, he accused Israel of committing war crimes.
Iran is defending itself against a barbaric aggression. We are entitled, tasked, and determined to defend our territorial integrity, national sovereignty, and security with all force. This is our inherent right.
Foreign Minister Araghchi called the Israeli action a betrayal of diplomacy, pointing out that the attacks began just days before he was supposed to meet President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, in Oman. President Trump has said that Iran should have agreed to a deal with his envoy earlier. He's called for Iran's unconditional surrender and has threatened to help Israel destroy Iranian nuclear sites, a decision he will make within the next 2 weeks, according to his spokesperson. But he's also been sending mixed signals as opposition brews in his MAGA movement about U.S. involvement.
It is not too late for the government of Iran to do the right thing.
That's the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Dorothy Shea, who calls Iran a menace to the world.
President Trump has been clear in recent days that Iran's leadership must completely abandon its nuclear enrichment program and all aspirations of acquiring a nuclear weapon.
Iran has insisted that its nuclear program is peaceful and that it has the right to enrich uranium for that. The last time he was in office, Trump pulled out of a deal negotiated by the Obama administration to limit Iran's nuclear enrichment program. The Trump administration now says that the Iranians have all they need for a nuclear weapon. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The United States is currently dealing with multiple national emergencies all at once, according to President Trump. He says there is a national emergency at the southern border, also an energy emergency, also an economic emergency, to name a few. The president has wielded these to enact some of his most wide-reaching policies, policies from pushing fossil fuel production to trying to complete the border wall with Mexico to setting sweeping tariffs. And here's Kat Lonsdorf has been following this. She is with me now. Hi, Kat.
Hey, Mary Louise.
I want you to start big before we zoom in and you give us some details. When a president declares a national emergency, it triggers certain powers. How's it work?
Yeah, so a president can declare a national emergency at any time without approval from Congress. And that declaration allows presidents to temporarily enhance their executive powers. The idea is that passing laws through Congress is too slow in rare moments of crisis, and the president needs the flexibility to act quickly and send resources where they're needed. But what constitutes an emergency has never been defined by law, creating a system of trust around the president to be able to identify an emergency. You know, essentially, it's an emergency if the president says it is.
Worth pointing out, plenty of presidents have said it was. President Trump is not the first president by any stretch to invoke emergency powers. Is there something unique, unusual about the way he is doing it?
Yeah, so you're right. Presidents have traditionally relied on emergency powers in many different situations. They've used emergency powers for things like freezing assets or imposing sanctions on specific foreign entities, or in times of notable crisis, like after the 9/11 attacks with George W. Bush, or the COVID pandemic that was a national emergency declared by Trump in his first term and later ended by Biden. But there are two notable ways that Trump is using emergency powers now. First, the rate at which he's using them, and second, what he's using them for. So for the rate, Trump has declared 8 national emergencies in his first 100 days in office in this term. That's more than any other modern president has done in that same time period. Hmm. For comparison, Biden declared 11 over his whole 4-year term. Obama declared 12 in his 8 years. George W. Bush declared 14 in his 2 terms.
And just to sum up again, Trump 8 in the first 100 days. Okay, go
on. Exactly. You know, and I should say the White House defends Trump's use of emergency powers, saying that he is rightfully using them to quickly, quote, fix the many catastrophes he inherited from Joe Biden.
Yeah, okay, stay there, because you just told us about the rate. The other piece of that, the what Trump is actually using these emergency powers for, what's that?
Yeah, so constitutional experts say Trump seems to be primarily using emergencies to try to carry out his domestic priorities more quickly than trying to pass laws through Congress, which is the traditional constitutional check on executive power. It's a pattern that started in Trump's first term when he declared a national emergency to help fund the southern border wall after Congress didn't approve the full amount. You might remember that.
I do.
That move triggered lawsuits, but the cases didn't reach the Supreme Court before Biden took office and overrode that emergency. And then, you know, Biden continued that pattern when he used emergency powers to forgive student loan debt after Congress blocked his plan. That was ultimately struck down by the Supreme Court.
Okay, so this is important. The courts, up to and including the Supreme Court, as you're noting, they represent a check on this kind of presidential power. You just told us how it worked in the first term. What about this second term? Where do legal challenges now stand?
Yeah, there have been many legal challenges, and some courts have ruled that Trump is exceeding his power, particularly in regard to tariffs. Appeals for that are ongoing. Challenges to Trump's emergency orders have yet to reach the Supreme Court, but it seems likely that some of them will. And that's what some legal experts I've talked to are really worried about, how this all could play out in the Supreme Court, especially if the court rules in favor of the administration.
Say more about that. Why are they really worried?
Well, some legal experts worry if the courts side with the administration, it could lead to an upending of the constitutional balance of power, essentially give the presidency more executive power and take away power from Congress. I talked to Kim Shepley. She's a professor at Princeton University and a scholar on emergency powers.
frankly, you know, I mostly study the fall of democracies in other places, and it's through this expansion of unlimited executive power, that's the path I'm worried we're on.
Other legal experts I talked to were less certain how the Supreme Court would rule on something like this, but they all told me they were certainly watching it for this reason.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, thank you for watching it so closely.
Thank you.
After working as an emergency medicine physician in Kansas City for more than a decade, Catherine Miner decided it was time for a change.
So in 2022, she started exploring other ways to help people in her community and pursued lifestyle and culinary medicine.
Culinary medicine is centered on nutrition, food safety aspects, teaching kitchens, being a physician and kind of slash pseudo chef.
When she decided to pivot, Miner ran into a snag. She was laid off from her job.
So she started volunteering at a public library that was running teaching kitchens for medical student groups and patient groups.
If you're not familiar, teaching kitchens are hands-on spaces. People learn about nutrition and healthy cooking techniques.
She loved it so much that she started doing similar work with a local church's program for the homeless, primarily serving women and children. She told us about her work as part of our series, Here to Help.
I bought myself an induction burner with some pots and pans and focused on it being very simple. Like these are people who are coming from homelessness.
As soon as she got in the door of the program run by Hillcrest Ministries in Lee's Summit, Missouri, she was eager to see what she had to work with.
So I took a tour of their pantry and I'm like, well, I see a big problem here. Like you have nothing to flavor this stuff.
There wasn't exactly a full spice rack available.
There was the gravy packets and things of salt, and that was it.
Miner, being an optimist, looked past what was lacking and leaned into what was possible for the program's clients.
My whole thing was like, I'm going to make this super simple because I know that if they're starting out and finding an apartment, they're starting from scratch and they're not going to have an Instapot.
So she did some investigating.
I got there like an hour ahead of time and I saw a variety of frozen vegetables, some spaghetti. Oh my gosh, there's fresh oranges. And I found some garlic powder, and I already bought my soy sauce.
Okay, quite the bounty. I'm kind of liking where this is going.
I sauteed the vegetables, cooked the spaghetti on the stove, and then I was making that peanut sauce, like a kind of a Rachel Ray-inspired peanut sauce, and they all looked at me like I was crazy.
And the verdict?
They all had seconds. You know, even the lady that called me crazy got up and had a second helping. And so I felt like that was a home run. And really helped me feel like, all right, I'll do this again.
So she did. Many lessons, many volunteer hours later, Miner has the kitchen running at full speed.
More recently, she received a request to teach people how to make crockpot meals.
So we've arrived at Hillcrest, going through the pantry in preparation for tonight's meal. Have an excellent source of bean choice, canned beans. Lots of elbow macaroni.
That night's menu item was, drumroll, minestrone.
So I'm going to add the entire box of gluten-free elbow macaroni. I like to hold the two sides of the kale down, fold them up a little bit, and then with a claw of my left hand, holding the leaf down and keeping my fingers safe, slice these into sort of some ribbons.
Miner says she sees her work with Hillcrest as a way to take at least one burden off the plate of someone looking for stable housing.
For more stories like this and to nominate someone else doing good in your community, you can visit npr.org/here to help.
This is NPR News.
Kit Marvel's new book, Human Nature, tests what it means to be a scientist.
I had this notion that we should all be perfectly objective, neutral, scientific robots. Then it dawned upon me that that's not the way to make yourself more credible.
Climate scientist Kate Marvel, the latest on Iran and Israel and all the news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Gabby Giffords has been fighting for gun safety since she was shot in the head 14 years ago.
I asked the former congresswoman her thoughts in this moment of rising political violence.
I'm optimistic. It will be a long, hard haul, but I'm optimistic.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Trump is saying today that he's giving Iran a period of time to reach a ceasefire with Israel, even as diplomatic efforts to stop an expansion of the fight were underway in Geneva and at the United Nations. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more on meetings in Geneva between Iran's top diplomat and European officials.
It's not at all clear that a diplomatic deal is really possible in this short window that's opened up, with Trump saying he would make a decision within 2 weeks about whether or not he would join this effort to bomb Iran. But the Europeans are seizing on this moment. The French ambassador to the UN told an emergency Security Council meeting today that there is still time for a deal. The British ambassador said a return to diplomacy is urgent.
Earlier today, the UN Security Council met in emergency session. Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for Israel and Iran to give peace a chance before the conflict explodes beyond control. The Veterans Affairs Clinic in downtown Los Angeles has reopened after 2 weeks. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports clashes between protesters and police had forced it to shut.
The VA secretary took what he called the difficult decision to close the ambulatory clinic on June 9th, when confrontations between police and those protesting the Trump administration's stepped-up immigration raids sometimes turned violent. The clinic was defaced with graffiti. It's adjacent to federal buildings at the center of the clashes. The VA secretary has asked state and local officials to cover costs to repair damage done to the facility. According to VA, 2,500 veterans had to cancel or reschedule appointments due to the closure, which lasted through Thursday. LA is home to the country's largest number of veterans living on the streets, including many in the area hardest hit by the unrest. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The Dow closed up 35 today, the Nasdaq off 98. This is NPR News. British lawmakers have voted for new legislation that could legalize assisted dying in England and Wales. Debate in the upper house of parliament is still ahead, and passage is around 4 years away. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more.
This is the biggest and most sensitive social policy issue since Britain legalized abortion in 1967. The vote came after an emotional debate, and it was close. By a margin of just 23 votes out of more than 600, lawmakers in the lower house of parliament, the House of Commons, have backed a law that would allow terminally ill adults over age 18 to apply for assisted death if doctors say they have less than 6 months left and if they're capable of taking the fatal drugs themselves. The bill covers only part of the United Kingdom, England and Wales, and goes next to the House of Lords for more scrutiny before final votes. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
With the collapse of a planned mega merger last winter, Kroger is announcing that it's closing 60 stores around the country. The business deal to combine with rival Albertsons was crushed in court in December when the Biden administration argued against it. Stores that are closing are considered underperformers, and overall in the last quarter, Kroger is reporting that sales have increased 3.2% at their grocery stores, with people eating at home more frequently. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Total Wine & More for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This week, an email landed in my inbox, subject line, an assassination in Minnesota, a reference to the killing last weekend of a Minnesota state representative and her husband. The email was a fundraising pitch to support efforts by Democrats to fight gun violence. What caught my eye was who was making the pitch. Gabby Giffords, the former Arizona congresswoman who, as her email notes, knows the horror of a targeted shooting all too well.
January 8, 2011 changed my life forever. I was a congresswoman. I was shot in my head while me was a constituent. I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk.
Gabby Giffords speaking with me in 2022. As she mentioned, she has struggled with talking, with speech, since she was shot outside a Safeway in Tucson. Since then, 14 years now, she has worked for gun safety. She co-founded Giffords, that's an advocacy group, and she joins me again today along with Emma Brown, the executive director of Giffords. Welcome to you both.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
And I want to add a note on how we are doing this interview. The Giffords team suggested that we pose specific questions in a specific way to enable Gabby Giffords to give fuller answers. So what you are about to hear is me asking some of those questions, and then, when needed, following up and asking additional questions of our own. I want to start with Melissa Hortman, who was the Minnesota lawmaker who was killed along with her husband. Gabby Giffords, I know that you were friends with her.
Yes, Melissa Horton. Perfect, perfect, perfect.
Yeah, Gabby met Melissa several years ago when we were working to pass gun safety legislation in Minnesota. So when she was the Speaker of the Minnesota House, she and Governor Walz helped us get a red flag law passed in Minnesota, as well as an expanded background checks law. It is a really devastating loss that obviously also hits very close to home for Gabby and for the origins of this organization.
Speaking of getting legislation passed, this month marks the three-year anniversary of the passage of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which enhanced background checks for young gun buyers. It increased funding for mental health services. It did a bunch of other things. Congresswoman, are you optimistic about further meaningful change on this issue?
I'm optimistic. It will be a long, hard haul, but I'm optimistic.
You know, this week on Tuesday was actually also the 10-year anniversary of the Charleston shooting.
Yeah.
So Gabby and I actually were in Charleston to mark the 10 years with Mother Emanuel AME Church. And Gabby got up at the service. And Gabby, do you want to share what you said?
Hope and faith. Hope and faith. Hope and faith.
Hope and faith. We think about the tragedies that pile up from guns in America, and often the last thing people think of is hope and faith, but
it's hard.
It is really hard, you know. Yeah. But I was sitting there in that church on Tuesday, and Gabby was up at the pulpit, and she said, "Hope and faith," and you could hear the room inhale.
Yeah. I started this conversation by talking about the email, the fundraiser email that I received from you, Congresswoman, this week, and you signed that email with courage, which says a lot. Do you not ever want to give up?
No way, Jose. Move ahead, to not look back. I hope it's are inspired to keep moving forward no matter what.
You know, Gabby says the words move ahead a lot. It's part of a lot of her speeches, part of the words that she has relearned. And there's actually a little bit of an origin story to that, if you'd permit me telling it. When Gabby was a kid and a teenager, she loved theater, specifically musical theater. And one of her favorite shows was Annie.
The sun'll come out tomorrow, so you've got to hang on till tomorrow.
That one.
Come what may.
Woo-hoo! That's right, that one. Yeah, it's very good.
Clapping.
Yeah, yeah. And so she and her mom, Gloria, would sing that to one another when she was a kid. And then when Gabby was shot, you know, she was in a coma for some days after the shooting. And her mom, Gloria, sat by her bed and held her hand and sang to her, you know, tomorrow, tomorrow. And that essence, you know, of the hope that there may be a tomorrow that is different, the courage to move ahead, is really at the core of the work that we do and how Gabby approaches the work. And as a side note, the bullet that entered her brain impacted her ability to speak. You know, she knows what she wants to say, but she can't get the words out. It actually didn't impact her musical ability.
No.
Which is a miracle.
I can tell. Yeah.
So she has perfect, she has perfect tune, far better than I do. And her recall and her ability to sing has remained untouched.
And maintaining hope in the face of the shooting after shooting after shooting in this country is beautiful. I will note that the last time we spoke, that was 3 years ago, and that was in the aftermath of the shootings in Uvalde, Texas, mm-hmm. that left 21 people dead. We're here today because of the deadly shootings in Minnesota. Investigators in Minnesota are still trying to figure out what the motive may have been. We do know that the man who has been charged had multiple guns in his vehicle.
He had multiple AK-47s in his vehicle.
There is no evidence, though, that they were acquired illegally. There's no criminal history that would have raised a red flag and prevented the purchase. What laws would have prevented this? What laws would you like to see changed?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Better gun laws and background checks.
Yeah, that's right.
But there was nothing in his background that would have, as I say, set off a red flag.
Right. Yeah, so there's still a lot to understand about the details of the shooting. But I think we need to ask ourselves, how is it that somebody who was that dangerous, who had a list of legislators on him, who was driving to their homes to hunt and kill them, was allowed to roll around with at least three AK-47s and a handgun and military gear? So that, you know, I think is the fundamental question. And your question about what policies would have prevented this is a good one. And I think we'll know more about that as we get more details on this. And Gabby, I think one thing we would also just point out is that something that surprises people a lot about this issue is how much progress we've made. You know, just like you don't think about hope when you think about guns in America, you don't think about progress. But in actuality, you know, Gabby founded this organization 12 years ago. And in that period of time, we've passed over 700 laws at the state level to further gun safety. And you just heard her say better gun laws. And that's because, you know, in states that have stronger gun laws, fewer people are dying. That's been proven now.
Last question, and this is for you, Gabby Giffords, and it's about the long view. It has been 14 years since you were injured. What have you learned from your experiences over those 14 years?
To be grateful for friends and family, and to live every day to the fullest. Hope, hope, hope.
Yeah. That is former Arizona Democratic Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and Emma Brown, the executive director of Giffords, the advocacy group she co-founded to promote gun safety. Thank you to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. On a muddy, muggy day in Brooklyn's Prospect Park, it's time for the big game, part of the softball playoffs for 11 and 12-year-old girls. You can expect a whole lot of cheering, and as reporter Sally Herships finds, you may also hear singing.
Ellie, L-E-A, L-E-A, day O-F-F, lead off, batter, lead off, batter, we're waiting for...
Over on field six, 11-year-old Mina Berman is ready.
So it's the playoffs. It's the first round of the playoffs, and if we lose, we're out. And so we really need to win this.
Mina's softball team is called the Renegades.
We dominated in our last game. We won 20-8. So I have a good feeling about this. We can do it.
Maywin Donaldson isn't so sure. That win was their only one of the season. across the diamond. The other team is warming up. Somehow, their girls look bigger. Their name, terrifyingly, is the Devils. Big rivalry, high stakes, but both teams are starting with the same play, singing, or more specifically, chanting.
Her name is Mina. Mina is a friend of mine!
Mina is a friend of mine!
She can hit that ball real fine!
She can hit that ball real fine!
Unlike in other sports, in softball, it's the players, not the fans, who do the singing. The Renegades are in the field now, and Emily Levin and Lola Palazzolo are watching their team through the fence. The chants have been the subject of a lot of team texts.
What's the reason for the chants?
Because it just motivates and gives them confidence in themselves.
And it's just like, so that you, they can like feel better in the field and like when they're batting, so they have more confidence.
And it motivates them, and it's just fun to chant.
There's a chant for almost every moment in the game, and all of them require full-on K-pop selfie energy.
My name is Sage, and you know what I got?
What do you got?
I got a team that's hotter than hot.
How hot is hot?
Behind home plate, Caroline Weiss, Emily's mom, is sitting in a camping chair. She says she appreciates the team nature of the sport.
No one is ostracized for making an error, and that's awesome. It's like people just get cheered for no matter what.
Weiss says that's nice, especially for preteens who can be clicky. And chants are a huge part of that team spirit. A few innings later, the sun is out, it's hot, and you can almost smell the sunscreen. The Renegades have fallen behind. But as she walks off the field into the dugout, catcher Maeve Clark Howe is still optimistic.
So guys, what's the score?
2-15.
And you think you can come back?
I think we can get close, yeah.
On the other side of the diamond, the Devils are also chanting.
Is she high? Is she low? Is she fast? Is she slow? Is she in? Is she out? Is she all about? We don't care. We don't care. We can hit it anywhere. Watch the pitcher. Watch, watch the pitcher. Watch the pitcher. Watch how she pitches.
One final devilish pitch, and the game is over. Final score, Renegades 2, Devils 17. As they say here in Brooklyn, wait till next year. In the meantime, the Renegades have a proven method for keeping their spirits up.
S-U-P-R, we're Supergirls, that's what we are, we're Supergirls, why can't you see we're number one, not two, not three?
For NPR News, I'm Sally Herships in Brooklyn.
Good. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. We'll see one of the most high-stakes moments in sports this Sunday, Game 7 of the NBA Finals. The Indiana Pacers kept hope alive last night with an epic win against the Oklahoma City Thunder. With so much riding for both teams, we called up Mike Volkanov from The Athletic, who's been following the games closely. Welcome back to All Things Considered, Mike.
Thank you for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Oh, we appreciate you. Okay, so I have to say, like, a lot of people thought this matchup of these two small market teams would be kind of boring, right? But instead, there's been all this great basketball so far. And this is, if I'm correct, the first Game 7 in 9 years. What do you think the viewership is going to be like on Sunday?
I think a lot of basketball fans thought this would be a short coronation for the Oklahoma City Thunder, who were the best team in the NBA all year. Instead, we've gotten just an exquisite series that's now been pushed to 7 games, a very rare Game 7. Viewership has been low for the finals so far. I haven't checked the numbers for Game 6 if they've come out yet, but you know, through the first 5 games, I believe it was the lowest rated or very close to the lowest rated NBA finals that hadn't happened during a pandemic season. But people usually do tune into Game 7. You can see sometimes that a Game 7 attracts maybe even as twice as many people as who watched a Game 1.
Okay, well, as you were saying, the Thunder, they were favored to win, and no one really had the Pacers making it even to the finals. Now it's 3-3, so who is the underdog here exactly? What do you think?
I think the Pacers are still the underdog. You know, they did come in as the pretty big underdog coming into the series. And Game 7 will be in Oklahoma City. So the Thunder do have home court advantage. Teams that are playing at home in Game 7 in the finals are 15-4 in NBA history. But the way the series has gone, it's not going to be a shock if the Pacers pull it out.
Well, can you just explain how have the Pacers been able to hold their own against Oklahoma?
They've done it in a number of ways. You know, one, their style of play is just, one, it's so fun to watch, but also it kind of works very well against how the Thunder like to play. They like to get up and down the court quickly. They play fast. They like to push tempo. They get up a lot of threes. The Thunder, who do not shoot as many threes, you know, kind of fall into a math problem against that. And the Pacers just have this kind of like team style of play where they do have some stars like Tyrese Haliburton and Pascal Siakam, but anyone can contribute on any given night, and the ball can find so many shooters, all of them who can make shots, and that's worked against the Thunder and their really shark-like style of defense, which has just obliterated the other teams it's faced this season.
Okay, the question you know I am going to ask you, because both teams here have a chance to earn their very first title ever on Sunday, so who do you see taking this one?
Man, predictions are just the downfall waiting to happen.
Assume the opposite of what you say is actually what's going to happen.
Yeah. Look, I'll make the easy prediction, which is I still think it's going to be Oklahoma City. They won 68 games during the regular season. They're playing at home. They have the reigning MVP, the best player in the league this season. Those are usually the right conditions to win a game like this. But, the Pacers have just been so tough all series long. And if it stays tight late, you know, the Pacers have shown these entire playoffs that they are the team who are best equipped to win that kind of game.
That was Mike Volkanov from The Athletic. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. I hope we can all enjoy a great game.
It's been a long wait for fans of the game-changing horror thriller 28 Days Later. That film opened in 2002. Its well-received follow-up, 28 Weeks Later, arrived pretty quickly in 2007. But fans have been cooling their heels for almost 2 decades, awaiting 28 Years Later. It opens this weekend, and critic Bob Mondello says it was worth the wait.
We begin, oddly enough, with Teletubbies, children watching a scratchy videotape behind closed doors as their parents scramble frantically outside.
Sit down, please. What's going on?
Jimmy, sit still, keep quiet, and do not move from the spot.
It is 28 years ago. And what these kids need protecting from is a rage virus developed in a bioweapons lab, now turning all of England into ravaging flesh eaters. The story picks up in the present in an island compound just off the English coast. Words on the screen say that though the rage virus appeared to have made it to the rest of Europe at the end of 28 weeks later, the world successfully contained it. Britain has now been quarantined, with warships patrolling the coast and its remaining uninfected inhabitants effectively left for dead.
Once you walk onto that mainland, there's no rescue.
The compound's leader is speaking to Spike, a lad of 12 who's grown up on the island and is about to make his first foray with his dad.
Let's go.
Into infected territory. Once he kills one of the infected, he'll be allowed to join folks in the compound when they forage out here for food and fuel. Spike and his dad are armed with bows and arrows and are in the middle of an open field when they spot a naked figure on a hill, then another, then a lot.
Get back to the trees.
Spike's a decent archer, and he makes his first kill. He also learns something that will bring him back on an odyssey that director Danny Boyle and writer Alex Garland, the guys who came up with the franchise's original concept, have conceived every bit as much as a coming-of-age tale in a time of crisis as it is a tale of raging zombies. Spike's close relationship with his sickly mom, played by Jodie Comer, is central.
Your granddad was so silly. Everyone else thought he was so serious, but Romney was daft. You know, when I look in your face, see your granddad's eyes. It's nice.
Spike makes a face and sticks out his tongue.
Exactly.
I'll stay awake. Keep watch.
Okay, Dad.
This is an unexpectedly homey note for a horror franchise built around visceral thrills and just plain viscera. But Boyle and Garland have always had their eye on broader issues. In the 28 Days movie, released less than a year after 9/11, they infected society with implacable rage, then focused on the moral decay that went with it. In the new film, they clock what's happened since, a real pandemic and Brexit with its self-inflicted isolation of Britain. And for anyone with doubts that those broader themes are intended, they offer images of wars going back to the Middle Ages, accompanied by a chanted Rudyard Kipling poem, and they bring in Ralph Fiennes to offer an overview. He plays a doctor who's got a witchy Macbeth thing going after enduring rage-addled decades of sound and fury.
Do you know the words, memento mori?
No.
It means remember death. Remember you must die.
He tends a boneyard filled with what look like trees of femurs and shin bones, a veritable mountain of skulls, a testament to what unchecked rage can do to a society, shot, as was much of 28 years later, partly on iPhones that give scenes a grainy yet painterly look.
And so many dead. Every skull is a set of thoughts. This is a monument to them.
A monument that's likely to stick in your own thoughts long enough to get you to the next already shot sequel. 28 years later, the Bone Temple is set to open in just 6 months. I'm Bob Mandela.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education, at edutopia.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D.